Let's then move on to our remaining two items this afternoon, since it is 3 o'clock, and take item 373, please.
Amend regulation of lobbying entities and city officials to improve administration, clarify requirements, and auditor duties.
Okay, Auditor Caballero.
Good afternoon, Mayor and Commissioners. I am City Auditor Mary Hall Caballero, and with me today is Deborah Scroggin from my office. And Deborah oversees the lobbyist registration program in addition to her duties as the city elections officer. We are here with a proposal to strengthen sections of existing code that make transparent the activities and expenditures lobbying entities bring to bear on city policy choices and other decisions. The proposal also broadens the revolving door prohibition so that the public's interest is not made deferential to personal interests when officials, their at-will employees, and bureau directors leave their city jobs. The city's code of ethics was adopted in 1994. That document says the purpose of this government is to serve the public and calls on officials to treat their offices as a public trust. It also calls on us to ensure public respect by avoiding even the appearance of impropriety, and for policymakers to place long-term benefit to the public as a whole above all other considerations, including important individuals and special interests. In keeping with the Code of Ethics, Council in 2005 passed an ordinance requiring lobbying groups to register and report their activity. It also obligated certain city officials to report with whom they were meeting and when they received gifts from lobbyists. The ordinance authorized the auditor's office to establish reporting mechanisms and enforce provisions of the code. The model chosen back then emphasized disclosure, and our proposed amendments are in keeping with that choice. They require no additional resources for my office to implement. Our goal is to make clear the expectations and consequences of the code for the people who fall within its requirements. We think the public will be better served by a code that adds transparency, clarifies requirements, and is more straightforward to enforce. Deborah will now walk you through the specific changes, and then we have some invited testimony for you.
Good afternoon, Mayor and Commissioners. As Mary said, my name is Deborah Scroggin with the City Auditor's Office. So I have a brief summary of the proposed changes to City Code 2.12, the lobbyist registration program that I'm going to present, including a brief background on the program, why we're bringing these proposed changes now, and a summary of the major amendments. So the stated purpose of the lobbying regulation program is to preserve the integrity of the decision-making process by making public the extent of lobbying activities. It's primarily a disclosure-based program that requires registration and reporting from certain entities and also from city officials. The program was passed in 2005 and has been in effect since 2006. Oversight and administration is conducted by the auditor's office. I just wanted to give a quick snapshot of activity captured by the lobbying program currently. There's 39 registered lobbying entities right now. This number ranges between 30 and 50 throughout the year, depending on items coming before council. The types of organizations reporting activity range from small nonprofit organizations to multinational companies. The amount of individual lobbyists fluctuates between approximately 170 and 190, also depending on the issues before council. Right now, we have 188. In 2015, registered lobbying entities that are required to disclose this information reported $288,000 spent on lobbying, which is more than double the amount that was reported in 2014. These expenses include salary or other compensation to lobbyists, travel, advertising, gifts, and other similar items. So why are we bringing these changes now? The last time substantive amendments came before council was 2007, and we think it's overdue to present some changes. The initiating ordinance states that these regulations establish the transparency that fair and open government warrants. To that end, we think it should be continually updated and reviewed for effectiveness and to improve administration. In particular, there are areas that have caused confusion, both for lobbyists and city officials, and we want to address those with these changes. There are some really strong pieces of the lobbying program. In particular, The definition of lobbying is broadly defined to capture additional activity at the local level. Specific lobbying contacts between city officials and lobbyists must be disclosed in public reports for certain entities. And city officials are required to post their calendars of official activities, which balances out that transparency responsibility between lobbyists and city officials. These are all strong components of a lobbyist registration program. However, the pieces don't work together cohesively with the rest of the code unless there is little room for gray area, strong accountability measures, and meaningful enforcement mechanisms. The changes we're proposing today are a step in that direction. So the first change I'll go over is to close the lobbyist disclosure loophole that we think exists. Lobbying entities are required to register, disclose their activities, lobbyists that are working for them, and their expenses after reaching a certain threshold of lobbying, and that is set at 8 hours and a quarter. This singular threshold leaves room for financial expenditures to go unreported and disproportionately affect civic and nonprofit groups. That's because entities that spend significant amounts on travel and compensation and make other related expenditures may not need to register under that single hourly threshold. So with this proposed change, a lobbying entity would have to register after they spend 8 hours lobbying, the current policy, or $1,000 and a quarter. We think this will capture additional lobbying activity, be a more accurate picture, just using different resources. So I'm going to go into the prohibited conduct section. And first, I wanted to address an amendment that we had before you for this item. And this amendment was regarding certain boards and commissions lobbying for compensation while serving as a volunteer city official. This is an important issue worthy of consideration. Unfortunately, we added it too late, and it did not get the same amount of time for comment and feedback as the other changes did. To allow the officials affected by that proposal to digest information, air their concerns, we've proposed removing it for the time being. I can go into more detail from that if you would like. Otherwise, I'll move on to the post-employment prohibition section.
I'm sorry, what was catching up from the previous one.
Oh, okay. So we submitted an amendment to this code, and that was to remove the section on
PDC.
Yes.
Planning Commission.
What section
exactly.
Number is that?
Design Commission.
12080F.
Yeah, 2.1, 2.080. Section.
So in other words, you're removing
an amendment to
a restriction on those commission members.
Yes.
From lobbying until you have time to process it more.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay, sorry, keep going.
Okay, thanks. So on the post-employment prohibition section, in general, these types of policies we think are preventative, good government measures. They serve the purpose of preventing impartiality, independence, and trust in city decision-making by imposing sometimes a cooling-off period, and that's what our code does. This period creates distance from the special relationships and access city officials gain throughout their time at the city. And these types of policies have another very important impact. They prevent even the appearance of impropriety. Cooling off periods are typically 1 to 2 years. We suggest a 2-year period to allow for additional turnover and to diminish the appearance that a former official could hold special influence over city decisions. Under the city's current code, all employees are prohibited from lobbying city officials regarding any subject they were personally and substantially involved in for 1 year after their term of office or employment. That personally and substantially policy has been difficult to define and is hard to monitor. The proposed amendments instead provide a clear separation of city officials from their public service. It also appropriately narrows the individuals covered by the prohibition. Instead of being citywide, it focuses on top-level officials. The proposed changes prohibit elected officials, I'm just going to go through them individually. The proposed changes prohibit elected officials and their at-will staff, once they leave the city, from lobbying for compensation or other consideration, current elected officials and their at-will staff for 2 years. In addition, city directors, once they leave the city, would be prohibited from lobbying the director of their former bureau and the current commissioner in charge of that bureau for 2 years. We think this proposal is clearer and stronger than current language while balancing the expertise and unique perspectives lobbyists can bring to government. So we'd also like to add some meaningful enforcement mechanisms to this code. At the discretion of the auditor currently, the maximum penalty for violations of this code is $500. that has not been reviewed since the ordinance went into effect 10 years ago. The proposed change to the section would increase the fine from $500 to $3,000 per repeated violation. That's an amount...
Just on that,
sir.
If that's all, does it still provide for $500 for non-repeated violations?
Absolutely. It would be at the discretion of the auditor. And we
Okay, because I mean, given the language change, just reading the penalties provision, I wasn't clear on that. It seems to only talk about the period of repeated violations.
Right, so it would be up to $3,000 for repeated violations. And we would not charge $3,000 for the first violation, for instance.
Okay, but I think it leaves it a little unclear. It doesn't say anything about non-repeated violations, so it leaves it, you sort of puzzled, is there a maximum for a first violation, or is there any penalty at all?
So that would be something that we would clarify through an open administrative rule process that we were going to go forward with, and to outline the different considerations that we would have, such as the budget of the organization, the type of violation, whether it's very technical in nature or something else.
Okay, but it just seems, it's just worded very strangely now because it seems to only talk about repeated violations, and I don't think it would be hard to fix in the language.
Yeah, I don't think actually you need the words for repeated violations. Because if it's up to 3,000, otherwise, as Commissioner Novick says, it looks like it's only for repeat.
I'm looking for the city attorney because that was actually advice that they gave. But I'm happy to look at that and see if we can do an amendment.
I mean, it sort of implies that there's a lower threshold for single violations,
right.
But it doesn't say what the threshold is. So it's just confusing.
I think we can clarify that. Right, thank you. Okay, so the reason that we're doing this piece is to bring the penalties closer in line with other jurisdictions who have penalties for this type of law, and that would be Seattle, San Francisco, State of Oregon. They have $5,000 as their maximum penalty. So we think this amount allows the auditor's office to recover costs associated with the enforcement, including the ability to seek recovery of attorney's fees. So the next steps for the auditor's office would be to continue to focus on education and outreach regarding lobbying regulations. Our goal is to get the most disclosure as we can under the code. In particular, we'll be focusing the next 4 months, if these should pass, on increasing awareness of the program in general with targeted outreach to folks that would be subject to it. We're going to update public information, manuals, and increase the number and frequency of trainings. We'll also be creating administrative rules through an open process before the effective date. Thank you. That's all I have.
Okay.
I have
some questions. Why don't you go ahead with yours
and I'll ask a number of
questions.
First set is on the calendar postings.
Yes.
That's section 070D.
Yes.
It says that we're required to post calendars. And let me first say I totally appreciate this whole project. I support the vast majority of it. I'm just trying to understand what the requirements would be and how I would do them. So it says that unless otherwise exempted, calendars required by this section shall include the date and length of scheduled official business. What's the purpose of saying that the length of the meeting is important?
Well, one of the requirements to register is that 8 hours threshold of lobbying. And if we can have some idea of the length of some of these meetings, that helps us with kind of letting lobbying entities know that they may be subject to this ordinance.
Okay. I have half-hour meetings. If they end 10 minutes early or if they end 15 minutes late and the lobbying entity enters it differently, am I in violation if I say that it was 20 minutes when they say it was, or vice versa?
So I think it's how it's scheduled. We would want to see however you intended it to be. If it varied dramatically, perhaps that would be something to update on your calendar. But whatever it was scheduled as would be important for us.
And this is for all official business, so it's not just for lobbying meetings.
Correct. However, we've narrowed that down so that there's an emphasis on outside meetings and that you wouldn't have to have the extra administrative burden of putting all this information for internal meetings with your staff.
I don't think it says that. So that's something else that I'd like to have clarified. And then the second part of that section says, if scheduled activities include non-city staff and are private, the primary participants or organizations shall be listed.
Yeah.
So does that mean if I have a birthday party, I have to list everybody who's at it?
Well, are you having the birthday party? I think the question would be as a part of your official business. That sounds like it might not be something you would include on an official calendar.
So activities that reflect official city business.
Mm-hmm.
I actually was looking at the same language, and I think that it's relatively clear, but it might make it a little clearer to say, if scheduled official business activities include non-city staff. Just repeat the phrase.
Yes, that would be helpful to me.
Okay.
And then the other clarifying question I have is about the 2 years instead of 1 year, and particularly about including at-will staff. Mm-hmm. You frame that as high-level officials, and in some, I consider all of my at-will staff high-level officials. I currently am employing somebody part-time for $15 an hour while she's in school and she's helping with our front desk and other activities. She would come under this category. One of my policies is to try to employ folks who are getting their start in public participation and public business, and I'm hoping that they're going to get offered fancy jobs in either the private sector or elsewhere. So I'm just troubled by that provision and wondered if you could talk about what's the purpose of that.
The purpose is to capture everyone who is involved in activities that your office may be discussing and to prevent the conflict that may happen and the appearance of undue influence after that person leaves office and then may have different levels of access than someone else.
Isn't that up to the elected officials to prevent that undue appearance of influence as opposed to the at-will employee, him or herself?
I think it's everyone's responsibility to watch out for the appearance of impropriety. I would also like
to... I consider them to be public servants. What do you consider them to be?
Public servants.
Public servants. Right. But public servants at the risk of going bad after... That's why they need a 2-year timeout from future employment?
No, if you go back to my introductory remarks, this is about in keeping aligned with the code of ethics, where it lays out that we're supposed to avoid even the appearance of impropriety. And I think that the public trust, I don't think the public should have to understand what the intricate details of your relationships with your staff are, and I think that it's an appearance issue, that if it looks like the playing field is not level, that someone can come back in and essentially trade on information that they developed when they were public servants, that I think that is what chips away at the public trust.
Well, the current language does prohibit an employee from working on lobbying on an issue that he or she has had a substantial involvement in.
Right. And we're suggesting that is very difficult to define. Is that they spent 3 hours on a topic or 100 hours on a topic? I mean, that's why we're trying to clarify.
Yeah, but you're choosing sort of a blanket approach, and I'm sorry to interrupt, Commissioner Fritz. I'll be happy to cede my time back to you. But I think you are.
I'll let you both have at it for a while.
I think you're doing two things. One is you're penalizing people that have been loyal, hardworking public servants by saying for 2 years, you can't pursue any employment that is any remotely related to City Hall or
City
Government.
That is not what it says.
And then secondly, you're going to make it very difficult to hire good, inspired people who maybe hope to have careers, you know, either in the private sector or in the public sector, from ever wanting to go to work in City Hall.
And that's not what we're proposing.
That's what I'm suggesting is the impact of this, which is why I'm supporting keeping it at 1 year.
I would respectfully disagree with you, Commissioner. What it prohibits is coming back to lobby. So there's all kinds of employment possibilities for talented public servants when they want to leave public service. And all we're saying is that one of the things that they should not be doing is coming back to lobby their former elected official or their former colleagues. And so it's a very narrowly tailored prohibition around lobbying, not employment.
Have you ever heard the phrase, let knowledge serve the city? That's PSU's motto.
Right.
I think there's something to be said for having people who understand the quirky form of Portland government, which is pretty unique. You know, we're one of a handful of governments, one of one government left that has this quirky form of government. And I think, in my own opinion, I think it's useful to have people who understand and have gained experience through working in that system to help guide decision making for the public, for their clients, for those of us who serve in office.
Commissioner, let me come back and ask you for clarification for myself. I think that the 2 years is reasonable for the elected officials and the Bureau of Directors.
No,
I think we're just talking about the at-will staff.
Right. I absolutely agree with the elected officials and the Bureau of Directors.
Yeah.
But I'm concerned about the impact on at-will staff, so, in both attracting them and penalizing them for working as public servants.
So since I have a lot of questions, I am going to let Commissioner Fish go next, and then I'll take up my long list.
Well, I just want to strike while the iron's hot here on the prior conversation you had with two of my colleagues on the calendar issue. So, Deborah, here's the context. We find that from time to time there are discrepancies between the reports filed by lobbyists and our records. And I just want to just connect the dots on how this is constructed to make sure that we're all on the same page. Under the code, by the 15th of the end of each quarter, the lobbyist or lobbying entity is required to file their report.
Correct.
And that becomes a public record. There is a safe harbor provision in the code that gives city officials up to 25 days from the end of the close of the calendar to make any amendments without consequence. So the way we've interpreted this is that from the moment the lobbyist reports are filed, we have 10 days to do a quick scan to make sure that our records and the lobbyist records correspond. And the kinds of things that we often find is the wrong date is listed, or maybe the wrong time or something. I'm not trying to cast aspersions to the people filing, but these are human errors. And so as I understand it, there is that 10-day window to fix and to update a calendar or to make other changes if a discrepancy is identified. Is that correct?
That 10-day period applies for lobbying entities. For city officials who are required to post a calendar, that date is 15 days after the end of the quarter.
At the end of the quarter. So so then that, I guess, frames the other question, which is, so the city official does his or her best to get it all right. But at the moment that the lobbyist report hits, a light goes off and says, boy, there's a problem here. It has to get sorted out. Somebody has got a error in how they've reported it. Can that be amended thereafter without consequence of fine or penalty by the city official?
I think that's something we could consider, for sure.
Pardon me?
I think that's something we could consider.
Well, because my sense is, my sense is that you in particular are very focused on just getting it right. And if people make good faith efforts, you want to get it right. And that sometimes there's just human errors in how things appear. This is pretty prescribed, mm-hmm. but I also think there's a rule of reason. And we have found you problem-solving oriented. But I want to make sure that we're not handcuffing ourselves, because sometimes by the time when that lobbying report comes out, it's an additional tool to scan, to sort of verify. And we don't want to discourage people from doing that, because sometimes you find that either you or the lobbying entity made a mistake, and you correct it, as we should. And I think at least from the city official side, it should be done within a reasonable period of time without a penalty.
Okay. Thank you.
So I think this proposal has big problems, and I don't intend to support it. And I want to go through some details of that and questions for you. But first, some disclosures, because it's important to disclose so that people don't ascribe motives that aren't real. First, I am not going to lobby the city of Portland after I am mayor in any way, shape, or form for any reasonable time period, probably for the rest of my life. So I will not be subject to the provisions that we're talking about. So let's get that out of the way right away. Secondly, I think I bring a unique perspective, without being immodest, to this discussion. From 1979 to 1991, I served as a paid lobbyist for two different business organizations. First, the Oregon State Lodging Association, and then the Home Builders Association of Metropolitan Portland. I lobbied the Portland City Council, the Washington County Board of Commissioners, 23 other cities in the metro area, a couple of other counties in the state legislature. So I understand lobbying. And part of the perspective that I bring to this also is informed by any of us who goes to Salem, even today. There are hundreds of lobbyists active in the state legislative process, all subject to the Oregon Government Ethics Commission process, which is what we were subject to in the city, I believe, until what year did we establish our own separate lobbying regulations from the state?
2005.
What's that?
2005.
So I served as a member of this council for 10 years while we were under the state regulations. I see no discernible difference by having our own regulations. I'm sorry that that sounds threatening to you because it's your job, but I don't see any difference. The difference I do see, actually, is that there are a lot less lobbyists involved in city government now than there were 10 years ago. I mean, I've been really struck by that during this term of office. Where are all the lobbyists? There are maybe a half. There's one. On cue. Lynn, you couldn't have made a better entrance. So there literally are a half a dozen professional lobbyists who ever appear in these chambers. At least that appears to be the case, and I'll get to that a little later. In the interim, between working as a lobbyist, serving as a city commissioner, and coming back here as mayor, I worked all over the country. Not as a lobbyist, although some newspapers have occasionally described me as promoting streetcars. I was actually a consultant to local governments who hired my company in a competitive process, and then we did engineering design for light rail and streetcar projects all over the country. But I got to see the political cultures of lots of other cities. And believe me, I saw self-dealing, I saw conflicts of interest, I saw really outrageous special interest influence, and I saw real corruption. Employees in my company wore a wire in one particular jurisdiction where they worked, and the FBI came in and arrested 24 people that worked for the Department of Transportation in that city. So let me tell you, I can tell you about real governmental corruption. And it ain't here. It's not in Oregon, and it's not in Portland. So I'm a little puzzled as to why the city in 2005 bothered to enact its own regulations versus following the Oregon Government Ethics Commission process, which requires forms and disclosures and dollar tabulations and all the rest of the stuff that we duplicate in our regulations. So we're getting to the heart of the matter, which is what's the problem that we're trying to solve? Frankly, I don't see one. Not because I'm blind, but I would say because of that experience, I have a context that, frankly, you don't have, because I know I'm old enough that in 1979 you weren't doing this work. And again, I've had this context of working in places where there's real corruption, where people go to jail. In Miami-Dade County, at any given time, I think there's at least one elected official serving time. That's, by the way, where we wore the wires. You can look it up. So I'm being a little playful here, but I don't see the problem that we're trying to solve. But then I start seeing all kinds of side effects. So let's get out of generalities and get to some specifics, because law is about what's right and what's wrong. So let's get to real specific cases and let you give us some answers. Right now, so the city works with lots of organizations, public, private, nonprofit. We can't make a distinction in this code about, well, it's okay to lobby for a nonprofit, right? We can't say that, I don't think. So we have to treat everybody alike. So Hacienda Community Development Corporation is currently in the process of hiring an executive director. Would it be right or wrong for a current city, under your proposed code, would it be right or wrong for a current City Hall staff member to seek that position? And wouldn't that put Hacienda Community Development Corporation in a terrible position of hiring someone to work with the city who was barred from working with the city? Would it be wrong for that City Hall staff person to take that job? It's a yes or no question.
No.
It would not be wrong.
No.
But it would be contrary to your code. So we got to work on that.
No, it would not be contrary to the code if they accepted a position. It would be contrary to the code.
Well, then they couldn't do the job.
Well, if their job is lobbying the city, then...
Hacienda CDC has lots of relationships with the city, which under our very broad definition of lobbying constitute lobbying, so they couldn't do the job.
Well, that's a different issue than whether or not they should take the job. So I'm saying this code is not...
Well, that's a distinction without any practical difference. They shouldn't hire somebody who couldn't do the work.
So well, I would suggest if you're the executive director of a nonprofit organization, you have more responsibilities than lobbying.
So you're saying they should take the job but reconfigure it so that they don't work with the city of Portland?
I would suggest that if they've just left your office and take that
not
job.
Not my office. It could be anybody's
office. Under the proposed changes, then they would be prohibited from coming back to lobby their colleagues.
Okay, and therefore that it would be wrong. It would be foolish for Hacienda to hire such a person. Zary Santner, the former director of the Portland Parks Bureau, now, after leaving the Parks Bureau, began volunteering for the Parks Foundation on the Wildwood Bridge project and served as a paid consultant to help a group plan a new urban design around the Moda Center. Would that be wrong? Would she be prohibited from doing that work? Under your proposed ordinance, she would have to be interfacing with PDC and the Planning Bureau and PBOT and other agency, Parks Bureau, in order to plan the Wildwood Bridge project and in order
if she was acting as a lobbyist,
What constitutes acting as a lobbyist?
Based on the definition in the code.
Right. So she would be talking with people in city government. Therefore,
the city government folks are fine. We're talking about the higher level decision makers. That's when it's considered lobbying.
So if she talked to anybody on the city council or a bureau director or a PDC commissioner.
And was attempting to influence official actions of the city.
Right. So she would be prohibited from doing that. That would be a loss. Zary has done a magnificent job on those projects. The vision they've come up with for the Rose Quarter is wonderful. Ron Paul, my former chief of staff, left city government and became the executive director of the James Beard Public Market Foundation, seeking city funding and other partners for the construction of a public market. He would, I assume, not be eligible to do that if he were alive today and able to make that same decision under your proposal. And I assume you think that is fundamentally wrong for Ron to have done that. Because legislation is about what's right and wrong. So I believe you're saying that all three of those scenarios would be wrong.
Can I just take an example, though? He had been out for more than the length of time.
If it was more than 2 years, but it wasn't more than 2 years.
Can I just clarify something? I just like to say, you know, ethics laws, from what I have read and what I have seen being here, they're a lot about appearances, so it's not always about right and wrong. But a lot of times with government ethics, it's about appearances, and I think that may be the piece we're missing here.
Newspapers are about appearances. Law is about what's right and wrong. So I disagree with that completely because the next subject is enforcement. So, again, I mentioned
could I respond to something you said in this section?
Sure,
please. When you were talking about that, you know, there's not corruption here and there's not the terrible things that you've seen in other communities, how I would respond to that would be to say that these types of ethics codes and rules are about preventing those very things from happening. And
didn't happen before 2005 either here, because the political culture in Oregon is honorable, and we have a very high standard of public ethics.
Right.
You know, we've had legislative scandals in the past over people accepting vacation time in a lobbyist's condominium in Hawaii. So, you know, we have such a hair trigger when it comes to public ethics that, frankly, what's on the books in the city since 2005 hasn't made any difference that I can tell.
Well, and I would say that I think the disclosure provisions of this code do make a difference about that.
Yeah, I completely disagree. So let's talk about enforcement. I've been mayor and serving as the presiding officer of this council for 3 years and change now. The current law says that prior to offering public testimony before city officials, at the beginning of any meetings or phone calls with city officials, or in emails and letters to city officials, a lobbyist must declare which lobbying entity he or she is authorized to represent for that commission. Mm-hmm. That's the law. This is a guesstimate because I wasn't keeping track. I didn't know this was coming. But I've noticed that, actually, Mr. Bernstein's in the room. He's one of the few people that follows that law. I would guesstimate that maybe half a dozen times someone has actually disclosed that in this chamber. And I would guesstimate that 50 times there have been lobbyists in this chamber who didn't disclose. The auditor is the keeper of these records and the custodian of the moment-by-moment video of each of these council chambers. Have you sought violations against any of those folks who appeared here in the council chamber in the last 3.5 years who were lobbyists and who didn't disclose that they were lobbyists?
I certainly have. And
what was the result of those cases?
They were informed of the requirements, which is what we do when there are violations like that on a first-case scenario. I spoke with the person and let them know about the regulations. Also, I'd just like to point out that...
But you haven't fined anybody, right?
No.
Because the behavior isn't improving.
Right, but the exemption, one of the exemptions for lobbying is when you're in an open forum like City Council. And so I think that is a little...
Prior to offering public testimony.
Yeah, but that one, I just want to point out that it is still public testimony in that case. So there is some level of openness to it. Is what I'm
right, but they're not disclosing. You're not finding them, and they're not getting any better at it. So we might want to try to make the code we have work before we...
Well, I would suggest that we do that. And when we see discrepancies, you know, like I said at the beginning, that a lot of the code that we have and the program we have is was developed to be a disclosure model, and that's why we count on you to do your calendars and the lobbyists to report, because that's how we match up to see you are checking them, they are checking you, and that's how we do that. If you want something that is much more enforcement oriented with a lot more investigation,
no, quite the contrary,
then that's not the model we have, and we would need the resources to do those things.
Well, but how are you going to carry out all this without more resources? And actually have it mean anything, because the current disclosure obviously isn't meaning anything. They're not doing it. You're not fining them for not doing it. People in the audience aren't noticing that they're not
doing it. Well, in terms of fining, we never start out with a fine. We, like Deborah said, she contacts them. Sometimes they don't know the requirements so that they will register if they're, you know, over the 8 hours. And so it's a very much a stepped-up process. We don't start out with a fine. So if you have some concerns about people appearing in the chamber, then I would hope that you would alert us to that concern, and then we would follow up.
Well, again,
I've also spoken with your office about this particular piece. I just want to let you know I've spoken with your office about this particular piece and asked if that could be communicated, that particular rule could be communicated at the beginning of
council. I did that for a while.
I think that's helpful.
Yeah, I did that for a while. It didn't have any effect either.
Okay.
So, again, I don't want to be too harsh here, but I think we have a body of law on the books that was largely unnecessary because the State Oregon Government Ethics Commission process was adequate to the task of making sure that professional lobbyists were properly disclosing their activities. Again, it's swimming against the tide, but I'm here to tell you, based on 40 years of experience with government, quite a bit of it here, that this is a solution in search of a problem. We are the cleanest place in America when it comes to politics here in the Northwest. I won't necessarily include California in that, but that's another story. But Oregon and Washington are the cleanest place in the United States for politics. We have a great system for public disclosure under Oregon law. Lobbyists are few and far between in this chamber. Again, Mr. Bergstein, it's nice to have you here, but it's very rare to have a paid lobbyist actually in the room. And we hire great people who work in city government for a while and then go do something else in the community. And everybody knows that this person working for, PCRI used to be on Dan's staff, or that person working for the Parks Foundation used to be on Amanda's staff. People know that. We take that into account. But it doesn't have undue influence. But what you're doing with this proposed rule, if we are... weak-kneed enough to adopt it, is making it really difficult for good people to work here and then do anything else in Portland afterwards, and that would be a travesty. Because what Zeri did and has continued to do as a volunteer and as a paid person since she was Parks Director is simply wonderful. What Ron Paul did after he left my office, went to PDC, and then went on to be the Executive Director of the James Beard Public Market is an amazing public service, and I don't want to stop people from doing that.
Mayor, I have a couple of amendments to offer before we take public testimony. I've been looking more at the calendar requirements, and I going with it at the Lansing, that's fine. If it's not clear under, this is Section D, Part 1 again, colleagues, it's for the date of and length of official business, I don't see where it says that that's for meetings other than those with city staff. So I'd like to add at the end of that sentence, except for meetings with city staff other than city officials, because I don't think you want me to list every time I'm meeting with my scheduler to go over my schedule. So that's the first part of that. And then to delete and are private in the second section sentence, if scheduled activities include non-city staff, I would like them to list the primary participants or organizations, whether they're so-called private or not.
Yeah, but that was to get at, you know, various public events that it would be clear already.
Yeah, the public events, we're going to list that we were at whatever event it was, and that would be the organization. So you certainly briefing me in my office, list, saying that as long as I'm listing the organization, I don't have to list everybody who's there. So that's my First Amendment, is just to clarify that calendar requirement, which I think would make it a lot clearer. Is there a second for that?
Second.
Thank you. I don't know whether we want to take this as a package. My second one was to delete Section B under 12080, which is about the at-will staff. I have a little bit different opinion from the mayor in terms of bureau directors who are city officials. That can be really uncomfortable if they're in a different role soon after they've left city office. I think my main concern is the at-will staff within our offices who, as I said, I want them to be able to go on and do good things, and in some cases we'll want them to be able to go and give their expertise to the other offices. So I would suggest we leave the 2 years for city officials, including bureau directors, clarify that for contracts it's forever, but remove the at-will staff from this requirement.
Second. Where does that appear? I'm sorry. If
I got your page
second. Five. Page 5.
Oh, I see. It's the whole subsection B there.
Yeah.
Okay.
I second that.
All right. Okay. You want other proposals for amendments before we take public testimony?
Wait. I'm sorry. Could I just make sure that you want to take out all of Section B or just at-will staff out of that sentence?
It's only at-will staff is Section B.
You'd remove the entire post-employment prohibition for at-will staff.
Correct, and that actually gets to your concern about what's substantially involved in. Mm-hmm. I don't think that the public interest is whether the person in my office spent 10 hours on something or 100 hours on something. It's probably a value that they
I will
can.
Just note that is weaker than what's currently in the code.
What's that?
I will just note that that is weaker than what's currently in the code.
I know. You raised it as something to be fixed. What is right. The problem to be fixed is that what is substantially involved in. I see that there's a problem when city elected officials or bureau directors come and lobby. I don't see it as a problem when folks who may have had any kind of involvement.
Colleagues,
lower than that.
I know we want to get to public testimony, but that leads me to a conversation I wanted to have with the auditor's office, which is on this issue. I mean, the mayor's right. We traditionally have a squeaky clean ethics record in Oregon, or actually more specifically, we appear to have an unwritten rule that all scandals involve sex, they never involve money. But that is an unwritten rule. It's not a written rule. And we could conceivably someday in Oregon have a scandal that involves money. But that leads me to my main point, which is
this doesn't regulate sex.
Right, yeah. But I think that in terms of public perception of corruption, what the public is normally concerned about is people making a lot of money off their former public position. And if somebody left city employment and went to work as a highly paid lobbyist for a big business that does business in the city and makes a lot of money off it, I think people might certainly raise some eyebrows. But if somebody came to work at the city because they're interested in homeless issues, and then they got a job at the county working on homeless issues, and occasionally they were lobbying the city on how to address homeless issues, I don't think the public would be upset about that at all. So I think that it's worth having a discussion about drawing distinctions between going off and taking jobs, making a lot of money, and then going off and taking jobs for nonprofits and other governments. Although I have to say that after reading Nigel Jacobs' piece on hospitals today, maybe one might want to distinguish between nonprofits and only address those that are really nonprofit. But I just wanted to ask you for your thoughts on that general, you know, philosophical question. It isn't what people are really worried about, people going off and making lots of money off their government service.
Well, so one thing is that some jurisdictions have a waiver process that allows for an open determination of whether the city's best interest would be served by a waiver to the prohibition, and that is, you know, potential that we could add in. San Francisco has that, and they've had maybe one waiver per year.
But they don't exempt work for other governments or for nonprofits?
I believe they do exempt work for other governments. I don't believe nonprofits are exempted, although I'd have to take a look.
Deborah, can I come back to something that you said earlier? Because we've had two amendments offered for which we don't currently have the draft language. So I'm trying to just
track. We have the draft language for one because it's a deletion. But yes,
a deletion. Well, it's a deletion that has a further complication. So that's why I'm asking. If we delete B at page 5, then you said earlier, then we're actually diluting the existing prohibition. Because as I read A at the bottom of page 4, there is an existing prohibition for a period of time of a former at-will employee lobbying his or her former boss. So my chief of staff under this could not leave and come back and lobby me tomorrow, correct?
Currently, under something they were personally substantially involved in, they couldn't do that.
And if we simply delete B at the top of page 5, we're not just eliminating a proposal that you've made in your judgment to strengthen the code. As you said, we're actually weakening the code off of the existing prohibition.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
Well, but they've said that that's not really enforceable. And you haven't had a case, right?
Based on the definition of, personally and substantially involved, that is what, it takes a lot of back and forth and judgment on our part, and we're saying that we could make it clear for the employees who fall under this code if we clarify that language and didn't get into, was it 50%, was it 60%, was it 2% of some topic that came up.
Right. And yeah, but your proposed solution was at all.
And correct.
Yeah, I understand the reasoning behind Commissioner Fritz's amendment. Other suggestions for amendments before we proceed?
Subsection A only deals with us elected officials, right?
No, it originally dealt with or other employee.
And they're at will staff.
They struck that in order to create that.
Oh, okay.
So
it was for all city staff.
If you eliminate this, then this is modified as part of the proposal, so you actually go backwards.
So you're right, Commissioner. And I understand the auditor's question to me. So we're actually just striking no former at will. That does need to be further amended. It seems to me that we might need to carry this over. We're not going to get this. I'll work on that with you. And we also need, and I do move the auditor's amendment to strike F from 08-0.
So my suggestion is we leave all these amendments on the table because we're going to get testimony. This is going to need more work, obviously, if it proceeds. So,
and Mayor, can I just say that, and I appreciate that because there. The way we have a redline copy, Commissioner Fritz has asked that we do redline copies whenever the thing, and it actually makes it a lot easier for all of us to follow. So thank you for doing that. But the challenge is if you strike one thing, it's delicately balanced, and you're actually modifying another section to correspond. And we can have a vigorous debate as a council whether we want to approve or not any of these provisions. I want to make sure there's no unintended consequences of an amendment. And so I think. And I appreciate Commissioner Fritz suggesting that we reduce these to writing, cross-reference them, and make sure that we know exactly what's on the table, and then we can debate it.
Yeah, we might also want to involve some folks other than this little bubble of elected officials. So did you have a task force working with you from the community? Or?
Well, we did outreach to various ethics organizations, and we consulted some. So I have here who I spoke with. I did outreach to neighborhood coalitions, the League of Women Voters, the Center for Public Service, Tom McCall Center for Public Innovation, the City Ethics Group, and others.
Did you do any outreach to at-will employees in the building?
We did have a meeting with city your executive staff, absolutely.
Yeah, I might suggest that downstream here we might want to involve some of those groups and maybe some others, like the ACLU, because people that work here have rights, in maybe some kind of a further task force effort that gets beyond, again, the closed conversation of a few of us in this building. So it might be something worth pursuing.
And these also were distributed for general public comment as well, so we did our best to advertise that we were making these changes, and lobbyists also provided feedback.
Okay. Other questions? All right, thank you very much. You have some invited testimony, did you say?
Yes.
Okay. So let's invite them. I don't know who they are, so you'll have to invite them. I'm sorry.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Dr. Sana Raikov. I am an adjunct assistant professor at Portland State University and at the University of Oregon here in Portland. And I specialize in political science with an emphasis on American political behavior and psychology and trust in government. I'm here to just provide my expertise on the topic and not to give any opinion about what you should do with the proposal. Try to be neutral and objective with regard to this matter. So research shows that there are, like, by and large, three main concerns when we are talking about revolving door lobbying, because that's what we're generally calling this matter of public officials getting a lobbying job after they leave office. And the first of those concerns regards career concerns in the lobbying industry that they may affect government decision making. So, for instance, if elected officials are worried about their career after their term is over and after, I'm sorry, I'm mixing two points now. Let me get back and go back to the first point. So the first concern is raised with regard to career concerns in the lobbying industry that may affect government decision-making. So lobbyists may be concerned about their own career and about their own existence that may affect government decision-making. Another concern that comes up in the research is the prospect of post-governmental careers and the potential financial windfall of that. That can change the type of person who runs for office. So if officers or government officials are worried about what they may do after they're leaving their office, it can actually influence the people that are deciding to run for office in the first place. And then the third concern that shows up in the research is maybe the one that's most applicable here, and those are concerns regarding any disparity or access and influence over elected representatives create ethical issues or may create ethical issues and perpetuates the impression that government is controlled by a tightly knit elite. That's when we come to talk about citizens' perceptions and citizens' public trust in government. Whether these concerns or whether the concerns about revolving door lobbying are actually outcomes of any process or whether they are actually present here at the local government level doesn't really matter for the public. It's about the perception that they may be, and it is about the perception that they're therefore possible. Often these concerns with regard to revolving door lobbying undermine public and popular support for democratic institutions. Citizens perceive and believe that public officials are sort of cashing in on their government experience, and they shouldn't be doing that. So the appearance of undue influence itself casts aspersions on the integrity of government. This is why most governmental agencies and why the state of Oregon also has this ethics provision and has some sort of policy regarding revolving door lobbying. Furthermore, research on public trust shows that trust in government is decreasing. This is not a new finding. We've heard it in the media like daily. Know that overall, in comparison to the federal government, local government does fairly well, but ratings of public trust are still dropping. When we ask people what their biggest concerns are these perceptions of conflicts of interest and the perception that their elected officials are not serving their best interests but are actually serving special interests. Again, whether this is true or not doesn't seem to matter, because once people perceive that this is true, it's difficult to convince them otherwise. So values such as integrity, purpose, and also effectiveness are especially important to citizens. So why is this important? Well, as a scholar researching trust in politics and trust in government, we can kind of give several reasons for why trust in government is important, and they're very obvious. We need trust from citizens to have a working democracy. Citizens need to participate in democracy. But also we know that trust increases cooperation between the government and the public, so we can actually create better policy and create better outcomes for the larger society. Citizens overall want to be a part of local government, and they want to be heard, and they want to give their voice. So often, meetings like this are perfect opportunities for citizens to actually talk with their elected officials and let them know what they like to see. Unfortunately, many citizens develop slightly negative orientations about their local government. These negative experiences outweigh positive experience. The positive experiences are viewed as this is normal business. We pay our taxes. The government should provide for these things. And it's great that this worked out positively, but that's sort of the normal way of business. They tend to remember the negative experiences, and especially when those experiences harm public trust, it's really hard to get away from that, and the trust may be harmed permanently. So luckily, scholars have also come up with certain strategies to provide local governments and other government officials to include so that the citizens' questions to their government or citizens' doubt towards government are limited, and the relationship with government are actually improved. So three of those strategies are reaching out to citizens, show them what the government does, show them how it ensures to serve the interest of all citizens and not just special interests. Show citizens that they are being heard. The second strategy is listen to citizens in decision making and providing opportunities to make their voices heard, not just in council meetings or in public hearings, but also in surveys and in focus groups, invite them to meetings. Often this is done and citizens don't answer, but it's also up to the local government to really try to to invite and include citizens in that process. And then the third is maybe the hardest one to do. It's perform well, right? Don't make any mistakes and avoid any perceptions of conflict of interest. So even though the government can perform really well, citizens may take that as for granted, as this is what the government is supposed to do. But avoid any perceptions of conflict of interest to make sure that the citizens really see that the government has their best interest at heart. And also communicate those good performances to citizens. Of course, these strategies are not solving any problems with public trust, and we cannot have a 100% public trust rate. But they do help. They do help with the confidence of citizens in government, and they do help with perceptions. So much in politics happens without public attention. So much happens in committee hearings, in decision-making that is not directly available to the public, or the public doesn't pay attention to it from themselves. And the public does pay attention when something seems to be going wrong or something is going wrong. The topic of lobbying is one of those that kind of takes place behind doors for many citizens, and that's why they're fairly skeptical of it. So reducing any perception of potential conflict of interest or potentially serving special interest would always be a good way to go. Lobbyists are providing valuable information and expertise to the government, and I think maybe that would be something that a government should focus on more in communicating with its citizens instead of really just trying to keep this interaction